This is lecture 13 of Rudolf Steiner's lecture cycle, Practical Advice to Teachers, given on September 4th, 1919. You have seen in these lectures, concerned with teaching methods, that we have gradually approached the insights that are to give us the actual curriculum. I have told you a number of times that with regard to what already exists, we will have to reach a compromise as to the influence we take into our school and how we incorporate them. For we cannot as yet create, in addition to the Waldorf school, the rest of the social environment by which it ought to be surrounded. And so from our existing social environment, influences will stream toward us that will again and again frustrate any ideal Waldorf curriculum we might work out. But we will be good teachers in the Waldorf school only if we know how the ideal curriculum relates to our curriculum, as it will have to be formed in the beginning because of the influence of our external social environment. We must first be aware of the significant difficulties that will arise for children right at the beginning of their training. There will be other difficulties in the 13 to 15-year-old age group. The problems we shall encounter with regard to the youngest children will arise because the outside world already has an established curriculum. Such a curriculum stipulates all sorts of educational goals, and we will not be able to risk letting our children reach the end of their first and second years at school without knowing what children being brought up and educated elsewhere know. By the time they have reached the age of 9, the children educated by our method will have surpassed the others. But in the interim period, it could happen that they would have to show to some external commission of inquiry what they have learned by the end of their first year at school. The subjects that an external commission of inquiry would expect them to know are the very ones that it is not good for them to know. Our ideal curriculum would have aims different from the requirements of a commission of inquiry. Stipulations from the outside world will partly destroy our ideal curriculum. This is the position at the lower end of the Waldorf school. In the higher grades, we will be dealing with children coming to us from outside schools who will not have been taught by the methods that should have governed their education. The chief mistake attendant today on the education of children between the ages of 7 and 14 is that they are taught far too intellectually. However much people may hold forth against intellectualism, the fact remains that the aims of teaching are far too intellectual. Children will be coming to us who have a strong tendency to be like old men and women, who have much more of old age in them than children of 13 or 14 should have. This explains why in youth organizations such as the Pathfinders, when young people today call for reforms and stipulate how they want to be brought up and educated, they reveal such appalling abstractions, that is, such senile attitudes. Footnote: the Pathfinders are a variation of Sir Robert Baden-Powell's Boy Scouts. End of footnote. When our young people demand to be taught in a youthful way, as do the members of a youth movement, they are stipulating the principles of old age. We really do encounter this attitude. I myself came across a very good example during one of the sessions of a workers' council for cultural affairs, when a young member of a youth movement of some sort came forward. Footnote. After World War I, workers' councils of all kinds were established throughout Germany. End of footnote. He began to read out his absolutely tedious abstractions about the way in which youth demanded to be educated. For some listeners, this was just too boring. Everything he said was so obvious, and this very fact of being so obvious has something senile about it. The audience members grew restless, and the young speaker hurled into their midst, quote, "I declare that the older generations do not understand youth," unquote. But the fact was that this youngster, who was still half a child, was too senile precisely because of a thwarted education and thwarted teaching. We must seriously consider this when children between 12 and 14 years of age come to our school, and for the time being we are expected to give them the finishing touches, so to speak. Great problems arise for us at the beginning and at the end of the school years. We must try to do justice as much as possible to the ideal curriculum, and we must do our utmost not to estrange the children too much from modern life. In the very first school year, the curriculum contains a rather disastrous element. It is expected that children should achieve the aim of reading as much as possible, while little is required in the way of writing. Writing need only be started, but reading must be brought to the stage during the first year, where the children can read pieces both in Gothic and Latin script that have been read with or to them. Footnote: many of the Gothic characters differ radically from their Latin counterparts. Both scripts were used for writing German during Steiner's time. End of footnote. They must be able to do this in both Gothic and Latin script, while relatively little is required in the way of writing. If we could educate in an ideal way, we would start with the forms of letters in the manner discussed, and then we would let the children gradually change the forms, which we have ourselves developed, into the forms of handwritten characters. We will do this. We will not allow ourselves to be prevented from starting with drawing and painting, and then evolving the written letters from drawing and painting. Only afterward will we proceed to the printed letters. When the children have learned to recognize the handwritten letters, we will make the transition to printed letters. We will allow one mistake, however, because there will not be enough time in the first year to mold both the Gothic and the Latin scripts in this way, and then go on to reading both scripts. This would overburden the first year of school too much. For this reason, we will follow the path from painting and drawing to writing the Gothic script, and then make the transition from the Gothic written to Gothic printed letters with simple reading. Then, without first deriving the Latin letters from drawing, we will move directly from printed German to printed Latin letters. We will work this out as a compromise. In order to do justice to true education, we will develop writing from drawing, but on the other hand, so that the children can keep up with the requirements of the curriculum, we will also start them on elementary reading of texts in Latin print. This will be our task with respect to writing and reading. In these lectures on method, I have already pointed out that once we have developed the forms of the letters to a certain degree, we will have to proceed more rapidly. Above all, we must try to cultivate as much simple speaking and conversation with the children as possible during the first year. We read aloud as little as possible, but instead prepare ourselves so well that we can bring to them in a narrative way whatever we want to tell them. Then we seek to reach the point where the children are able to retell what they have heard from us. We avoid using passages that do not stimulate the imagination, and make as much use as possible of texts that activate the imagination strongly, namely fairy tales, as many fairy tales as possible. Having practiced this telling and retelling with the children for a long time, we start in a small way to let them give brief accounts of experiences they themselves have had. We let the children relate something they like talking about. With all this telling and retelling of stories and personal experiences, we develop the transition from the local vernacular to educated speech by simply correcting mistakes the children make without being pedantic about it. Footnote: this is necessary in German-speaking countries because the dialects bear little relation to the written language. End of footnote. At first they will make many mistakes, but later fewer and fewer. Through telling and retelling, we develop in the children the transition from vernacular to educated speech. In this way, the children will have reached the desired goal by the end of their first year at school. Nevertheless, we will have to introduce a topic that really ought not to be included in this very first year of schooling because it weighs on the child's soul. We have to teach the children the difference between a vowel and a consonant. If we could follow the ideal curriculum, we would not do this during the first year. But then an inspector might come at the end of the first year and ask the children to define an I and an L, and they would not know that one is a vowel and the other a consonant. And it would be said that this ignorance was the result of anthroposophy. We must make sure that the children can distinguish between a vowel and a consonant. We must also teach them the difference between a noun and an article. Here we find ourselves in a real dilemma, because according to the present curriculum, we are expected to use the German and not the Latin expressions for grammatical terms, and so we ought to say gender word instead of article. In this case, I think it would be better not to be pedantic, and simply to continue to say article. I have already given you hints on how to help the children distinguish between nouns and adjectives. You help them see how a noun refers to something that stands outside in space by itself. You say to them, quote, "Let us take the word tree. A tree is something that remains standing in space. But look at a tree in winter, and again in spring, and again in summer. The tree is always there, but it looks different in winter than it does in summer, and different again in spring. In winter we say it is brown, in spring we say it is green, in summer we say it is many-colored. These are its characteristics." Unquote. We first teach the children to distinguish between the characteristics that remain the same and those that change. Then we say, quote, "If we need a word to describe what remains the same, that is a noun. And if we need a word for what changes on the thing that remains the same, that is an adjective." End quote. Then you teach the children the concept of activity. Quote, "Sit on your chair. You are a good child. Good is an adjective. But now, stand up and walk. You are doing something. That is an activity. The word you need to describe this activity is a verb." End quote. In this way, we try to lead the children to the fact, and then we make the transition from the fact to the words. By using this method, we will be able to teach the children, without doing too much damage, the meaning of noun, article, adjective, and verb. It is most difficult to understand the nature of an article, because the children cannot yet grasp the relationship between an article and a noun. We shall have to flounder about in abstractions to teach the children the definition of an article, but they must learn it. It is better to flounder in abstractions, since we are dealing anyway with something synthetic, than to invent all sorts of artificial ways of explaining to children the significance and nature of an article, which is impossible. In short, it will be good for us to teach in full consciousness of the fact that we are bringing a new element into teaching. The first school year will afford us plenty of opportunity for innovation. During the second year, too, a great deal of this sort of innovation will creep in. But there will be much in the first year that is enormously beneficial for the growing child. It will encompass not only writing, but also elementary painting and drawing, since we need them as our starting point for writing. We shall not just teach singing during the first year, but also start instruction in music in a simple way, with the help of instruments. From the beginning, we will not only let the children sing, but also guide them toward an instrument. This will benefit them greatly. We will teach them the first elements of listening to the relationship between notes, and we will try to hold the balance between bringing out the musical element from within through song and listening to the tonal element from outside or producing notes through an instrument. All these things, painting, drawing, drawing, painting, and also finding their way into the musical realm, will be a wonderful way to develop the children's will during their first year at school. This focus is almost totally removed from present-day schools. If we can also guide these little children from ordinary gymnastics into eurythmy, we shall be promoting their will and development to a very special degree. I have been handed a curriculum for the first year of schooling. It says, religion, 2 lessons per week. German, 11 lessons per week. Writing, no specified number, but it is taught at length in the German lessons. Local geography, 2 lessons per week. Arithmetic, 4 lessons per week. Singing and gymnastics, 1 lesson per week. We will not follow this guide, for if we did, we would be sinning too much against the welfare of growing children. Instead, we will arrange, insofar as possible, to have the singing and the music and the gymnastics and eurythmy in the afternoon, and all the other subjects in the morning. In moderation, until we think they have had enough, we will practice singing and music and also gymnastics and eurythmy in the afternoon with the children. To set aside only 1 lesson a week for these subjects is quite ridiculous. This alone must prove to you how the whole of teaching today is aimed at the intellect. During the first year of elementary school, we are dealing with children who are only 6 or a few months older. When they are this age, we can quite well practice the elements of drawing and painting, and also music with them, and we can perform gymnastics and eurythmy. But if we give them religion lessons in the style of today, we are certainly not teaching them religion, but merely giving them a form of memory training, which is about the only good thing that can be said about it. It is utterly nonsensical to speak to 6 or 7-year-old children about the concepts that play a part in religion. All they can do is memorize them. Memory training, of course, has positive aspects. But we must be aware of the fact that we are presenting to the children all sorts of concepts for which they have absolutely no understanding as yet. There is something else written down in this schedule for the first year of school about which we shall think, or at least act, in a way that differs from the usual. During the second year, it appears even more prominently as a separate subject, good penmanship. Since we shall let writing evolve out of painting and drawing, there will be no need for us to draw a distinction between poor penmanship and good penmanship. We shall try not to distinguish between bad writing and good writing, and to ensure that all our writing lessons are such that the children always write well, so well that they need never distinguish between good penmanship and bad penmanship. This is possible despite the external curriculum. If we take pains to converse with the children for a long time and let them do plenty of retelling, making an effort ourselves to speak correctly, we will be able to introduce the matter of right or wrong spelling by making a few corrections, without distinguishing the two as different aspects of learning to write. In this regard, we will have to watch ourselves carefully. We Austrians have to deal with a particular difficulty as teachers, because in Austria, in addition to vernacular speech and educated speech, we have a third element, special Austrian school speech. In this form of speech, all the long vowels are pronounced short, and the short vowels long. If the vernacular said sun, and educated speech said zona, school speech would say zona. You cannot help getting into this habit and constantly revert to it, like a cat falling on its feet. It is very upsetting for the teacher as well. And the farther south you go, the worse it is, until you find this problem at its worst in southern Austria. If vernacular speech says su, the sun, S-O-N, school speech says sun. So you end up using the word zon instead of zon for boy, and zona instead of zona for what shines in the heavens. But this is only the most extreme case. But when we converse with the children, if we are careful to pronounce long what is short what is short, sharp what is sharp, drawn out what is drawn out, and soft what is soft, we shall create for them the necessary foundation for correct spelling. We must also watch carefully what the children do, correcting them and seeing to it that they speak properly all the time. During the first year, we need not do much more than create the proper foundations. With regard to spelling, we can remain in the realm of speaking for as long as possible, and let it merge with actual correct spelling last of all. This is the kind of thing that must be taken into consideration when it comes to approaching, in the right way, the children who stand at the beginning of their school life. The children who come to us at the end of their school days, the 13 to 14-year-olds, are already warped by too intellectual an education. Too much emphasis has been laid on the intellect in the way they have been taught. They have experienced far too little of the blessings of also having their will and feeling life developed. Consequently, we will have to make up for lost ground in these spheres just in these last few years. We will have to seize every opportunity to try to bring will and feeling into what is merely intellectual, by taking much that the children have absorbed purely intellectually and transforming it into something that also stirs the will and feeling. For instance, we can assume with absolute certainty that the children who come to us at this age will have been taught the Pythagorean theorem wrongly, not in the right way that we have discussed here. The question now is how we can contrive to give the children not only what they have missed, but also something more, so that certain forces that have dried up and withered may be enlivened anew to whatever extent is still possible. Let us remind these children about the Pythagorean theorem. We will say, quote, "You have learned it. Now tell me what it says. You see, you have just told me the theorem of Pythagoras, which is that the square on the hypotenuse is equal to the sum of the squares on the other two sides. But we can be certain that there is nothing in the soul of the children that ought to have penetrated as a result of learning the Pythagorean theorem." Or there was an end quote there, sorry. I now do something more. I show the children the theorem as a picture and explain how it is developed. I let the picture arise in a specific way. I say, "Three of you, come up to the blackboard. The first can cover this area with chalk. Everyone watch to make sure that no more chalk is used than needed to cover the area. The second can cover this other area using another chalk." And then I say to the child who has covered the square on the hypotenuse with chalk, quote, "Look, you have used just as much chalk as the other two children together. You have spread as much chalk on this square as the other two together, because the square on the hypotenuse is equal to the sum of the squares on the other two sides," unquote. In other words, I let the children get a picture by using the chalk. The children get more deeply into it with their soul by thinking about how much some of the chalk has worn away, so that it is no longer on the stick of chalk, but on the blackboard. Then I go a step further and say, quote, "Now I am going to divide the squares, one into 16 smaller squares, another into 9 squares, and the last into 25 squares. One of you will stand in the middle of each square and imagine that it is a field that you have had to plough. The child who has dug the 25 small squares in this big square has worked just as hard as those children who have dug the 16 small squares and 9 small squares put together. Through your work, the square on the hypotenuse has been dug over, and so has the square on each of the other two sides." Unquote. In this way, I link the theorem of Pythagoras with something that has a will element, will influence in the children, something that lets them imagine themselves doing meaningful work with their will outside in the world. I bring to life a theorem that they have had planted in their heads in a rather dead way. Let us now assume that these children have learned Latin and Greek. I will attempt to bring them to the point where they not only speak Latin and Greek, but also listen methodically when one of them speaks Latin and another Greek. And I try to bring vividly to life for them the difference between the life of the Greek and the life of the Latin. I would not need to do this in the course of ordinary teaching, since it would come about intrinsically in the ideal curriculum. But we need to make this point with the children who come to us, because we must teach them to feel that when they speak Greek, they speak only with their larynx and their chest. When they speak Latin, on the other hand, something of their whole being reverberates with the language. The children's attention must be drawn to this difference. I must also make them aware of the living quality of French when they speak that language and its very close resemblance to Latin. They must realize that when they speak English, they always spit out the sounds. The chest is less involved than when speaking French. Much is cast off. Some syllables are literally spat out before they've had their full effect. You need not actually say spit out to the children, but you must make them understand that in English a word dies off toward the end. In this way you try to bring the element of articulation with particular clarity when teaching languages to children of 13 and 14 who have come to you from today's schools. The end of Lecture 13.